From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take 2. I'm Amy Martinez. Well, we finally made it to Friday. Hope you have some great things planned for the weekend. Maybe something with a little holiday cheer coming up later in the show. When it comes to holiday songs in Spanish, there's a whole lot more than just Feliz Navidad, but we start today's show with State of Affairs. That's our weekly look at politics in the Golden State. Well, it wasn't quite the political definition of the term horse trading, but Nancy Pelosi came to terms, so to speak, that while she may be able to be Speaker of the House for now, later comes with an expiration date of sorts. We'll explain. And now, a Christmas poem with a sprinkle of politics. 'Twas the night before the next session, and all through the House, only one says they're running, and the Senate, quiet as a mouse. Intentions have been hung by the chambers with care, in hopes that the White House would soon be theirs. Delaney has done it, but who else will wade in? Will it be Sanders, Harris, or Elizabeth Warren? Those names and more are considering a run, but eventually they'll have to decide if they think they're the one. All right, here to get us into all this and more is Jack Pitney, Roy P. Crocker, Professor of Politics at Claremont McKenna College. Hello, Jack.
Hello.
And Marisa Lagos, political reporter for KQED and co-host of Political Breakdown Podcast. Hello, Marisa.
Hey, A, I didn't know you were such a poet.
There is so much that people don't know about A. Martinez, and that I also speak about myself in the third person, too. That's something brand new that I just learned about myself. All right, so let's start. Before we jump into the stuff I just mentioned, I want to touch on the big news of the last 12 hours. President Trump's former lawyer, Michael Cohen.
First of all, nothing at the Trump Organization was ever done unless it was run through Mr. Trump. He directed me, as I said in my allocution, and I said as well in the plea. He directed me to make the payments. He directed me to become involved in these matters.
That's Cohen with ABC News' George Stephanopoulos. The president has said he never directed Cohen to do anything wrong. Jack, critics have accused Republicans of not being outraged enough over all that's gone down in the last week. Where does the GOP stand with the fact that Cohen is going to jail for violating campaign finance laws?
Well, the latest soundbite from Rudy Giuliani is, nobody got killed, nobody got robbed. Therefore, maybe it's no big deal. That's, to put it bluntly, ridiculous. Nobody got killed at Watergate. Nobody got killed in the Oval Office with what Bill Clinton was doing in the 1990s. And Rudy Giuliani, in particular, is not one to talk about this because he, as mayor of New York, pioneered broken windows policing, the point of which was to go after offenses that were not violent in hopes of restoring the rule of law. So this is a very bad look for the Republicans.
Marisa, what's your take on how Republicans, especially here in California, have responded?
Well, I think it just fits with sort of how we've seen Republicans approach anything that Trump has done out of the norms or even potentially that's illegal. You know, Kevin McCarthy, like Giuliani and many others, sort of blowing it off, talking about the same way as Marco Rubio did, you know, like maybe we need to change our campaign finance laws. You know, I think that some of this is philosophical in terms of their objection to those finance laws, but more of it has to do with circling the wagons around Trump. And it just continues to be sort of amazing. I mean, we're talking about payments to a porn star, a Playboy model. I mean, things that in any other world, like, would basically end somebody's political career. And I think that, you know, it's been met with a shrug the way that pretty much everything else this president has been accused of has. And I mean, it's interesting, right, given how few Republicans there are in California, that they're, you know, still really backing him even after the real shellacking they got in November.
Well, one more thing on this, Jack. Do Republicans in general think campaign contribution limits infringe free speech?
Yes, as a matter of fact, a lot of Republicans sincerely believe that, and that's been an argument that's been going on for many years, and it's actually a legitimate argument on the merits of constitutional law, but that's separate and distinct from this. It is the law of the land, and if the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York is right, Donald Trump, President of the United States, broke the law of the land, and remember, as President of the United States, he has a constitutional duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. And that phrase in the Constitution was the basis for the articles of impeachment, both against Richard Nixon and Bill Clinton. So this is a very serious matter indeed.
All right, now to Nancy Pelosi. When Democrats took control of the House, even President Trump was suggesting that he'd be dealing with her as the new speaker. And it was Democrats, or some of them, who revolted against her. Now it looks like she's made a deal to win their support. Marisa, what deal was made?
So she's basically agreed to term limits for the leadership team in the Democratic caucus, 3 2-year terms and then maybe a fourth if you can get a supermajority of the caucus, which means that, you know, Pelosi could potentially last definitely through 2020, maybe, you know, in 2022. And, you know, it included some Democrats like Linda Sanchez, incoming Gil Cisneros congressman, who had said that they would vote against Pelosi. It's unclear if she actually needed this to get a majority next year when Democrats vote, well, the whole House votes. But I think that, you know, Pelosi really wanted to give a win to some of these insurgent Democrats. She wants them on her side. She wants to win by a big margin. She wants no questions about sort of her power within the caucus. And it's sort of funny to me because I think she really played this one masterfully. I mean, you can really see her political acumen on display here. She told us in August at KQED that she probably wouldn't have stayed on had Hillary Clinton won. So I think that in some ways, you know, she really wants to get this new Democratic House through the next 2 years, help Democrats potentially get back the White House, and that she probably would have considered retiring after that anyway. And so, you know, she kind of gave the people pushing back on her what they needed. All of this is still subject to votes in the House. So her allies who oppose it kind of have an out too, given that they're going to be weighing in on it in the future. And so it's kind of a masterful play.
Yeah, it kind of looks and feels like a win-win right now for everyone involved. Jack, House Republicans don't have limits on leaders, just committee posts. Why would this deal be important to the incoming class of Democrats?
Because they have had in recent years a retention problem. A lot of very, very promising Democrats were very frustrated because you had the old guard in the leadership for a long time. They were looking to move up. They couldn't do it. And eventually they found other things to do. Javier Becerra is a perfect example. He was in the Democratic leadership. Everybody regarded him as a rising star, but he was very frustrated. And he had the opportunity to become Attorney General of California, and he grabbed it. But now that there are going to be openings in the Democratic leadership in a few years, some of these rising stars, some of the very top Democratic talent is going to stick around. And that's very important for the party.
We're talking State of Affairs with Jack Pitney and Marisa Lagos. Now, earlier this week, President Trump met with Representative Pelosi and Senator Chuck Schumer to discuss border security. Here's a snippet of that conversation.
It's not easy for her to talk right now, and I understand that, and I fully understand that. We're going to have a good discussion, and we're going to see what happens. But we have to have border security.
Mr. President, please don't characterize the strength that I bring to this meeting as the leader of the House Democrats who just won a big victory.
Yeah, and it went on like this, a lot of bickering back and forth. Marisa, how much do you think this helped Pelosi win back support of some of those Democrats?
You know, I think what it really helped her with was winning back support of some of sort of the Democrats out, like throughout the country. I think that there was this surge of support for Pelosi. It's exactly what the party base has wanted to see, which is her in real time standing up to Trump, not taking anything from him. And I think that by virtue of that, some of the Democrats in the House maybe heard from their constituents or just got a different vibe. You know, I think a lot of the people having these closed-door meetings with her in the caucus already probably understood her negotiating strengths. But it really is interesting to see the switch. And I think that this fits with a narrative we've seen with women in power in general, which is they are demonized when they're asking for a job, when they're running for office, and they become pretty popular once they get into that office. And I think that, you know, Democrats haven't always known how to deal with the Republican attacks on Pelosi. And I think a lot of the party faithful are feeling a lot better about, you know, her leadership after this meeting. And apparently the company that made the coat that she walked out of that White House in is reissuing it because it's become so popular.
Power coat, right? Apparently so.
Power coat, yeah.
Yeah. Jack, one more thing on Pelosi. There seem to be two schools of thought on Pelosi and her relationship with the GOP. One, that she's a godsend for Republicans who use her to win House races. The other is that she's best suited to stand up to the president, as Marisa said, as we heard in the clip. Jack, which do you think sums it up best?
The latter one. I'm not going to hedge on that. It's the latter school of thought is right. The former school of thought assumes that if Democrats pick somebody else, that person wouldn't be a target. That's ridiculous. I can speak with some authority on this. I used to be a Republican opposition researcher. Mm. So trust me on this, as Trump would say. Whoever the Democrats picked as party leader, as speaker, would be the target of Republican attacks. If Pelosi were out, the next person would be just as much of a target. So Democrats ought to pick somebody who knows what he or she is doing. And right now, the person by far best qualified to do that is Nancy Pelosi.
All right. Adding another layer of tension in D.C. is that possibly by early January, we might know who will step forward to challenge Trump for the White House in 2020. Now, only one person so far, John Delaney of Maryland, has announced his intentions, completely announced that he is running. Marisa, where do some of California's possible candidates stand?
Well, we have Kamala Harris, who earlier was making the rounds, in some of these early primary and caucus states, has raised, I think, $6 million this last cycle for other Democrats. Seems pretty clear she's running, but she said she's going to make the decision over the holidays. Eric Garcetti, mayor of L.A., similar, both in his movement to places like Iowa and his intention to decide by the end of the year, you know, in consultation with his family. I think it's pretty clear that they both intend to run. And then we also have Eric Swalwell, congressman from the Bay Area, 38 years old, grew up in Iowa and has been making the rounds on cable news, kind of a dark horse a bit, right? He's very young, not very well known, but has kind of made hay out of the Mueller investigation. And then, you know, I think the billion-dollar question is Tom Steyer, that tech billionaire who spent a lot of money over the last couple of cycles raising the sort of grassroots Democratic base up, collected a lot of names and email addresses. And I thought, actually, that he would have announced by now. So I think it'll be interesting to see, the order in which some of this happens. But I would be personally pretty shocked if Garcetti and Harris didn't throw their hats in the ring come 2019.
Jack, what would be the biggest thing that you think would factor into Harris and then Garcetti's decision to do it or not?
Well, if we're going to be musical, you could cue in the money song from Cabaret. That's really what counts. Can they raise the money to be competitive nationwide? In the case of Garcetti, he has to worry about also public perceptions of Los Angeles. He was protested by homeless advocates, and anybody running against Garcetti can point to things in Los Angeles that physically don't look good. And in terms of the homelessness, in terms of all the problems that Los Angeles has, and as mayor, he can be held accountable for that. And there's a reason why nobody has ever gone directly from being mayor to being president of the United States. A mayor has a lot of vulnerabilities.
Marisa, one more thing on Kamala Harris for a second. I remember when Barbara Boxer's Senate seat was open, she came out early, right off the bat. I mean, right away. And it was almost kind of shocking how early she came out. Do you think that strategy will maintain with her? And what would the advantage be to being the first one out of this year to say, I'm running?
Well, the biggest advantage is that if you have announced and have a campaign team in place, you can actually start raising that money Jack's referring to. And I think that that's really important. I think we're going to see a lot of early announcements earlier than in years past for that very reason, because it's a huge Democratic field, or expected to be, because, you know, I sort of see it as this WWE cage match that Democrats are all going to engage in. I've talked to consultants who are close to Harris who said that same thing, that they really feel like the first quarter of 2019 is going to be very telling, and especially because you don't have a Hillary Clinton this time, right? You don't have somebody who already has the pledges of so many big donors. I think a lot of the big donors are waiting to see what shakes out. And so that's going to be, you know, it's sort of a game of chicken in some ways in that regard. But it is an important consideration. And I really just do think, you know, 2016 in so many ways changed the calculation for everyone. And I think we're going to really see that play out over the next 2 years.
Whereas you're going to have a lot of senators working on armbar submission moves for the next month and a half. Yeah.
Well, you know, what's funny is, you know, we moved up our primary to March in California, which is now Super Tuesday. There's two caucus states and two early primaries, we'll start voting around when Iowa goes to their caucuses. So the entire calculation around California, fundraising, campaigning, where to position yourself politically is going to be really different than it has been.
All right, one more thing. There were reports earlier this week that the Trump administration is mulling the deportation of thousands of refugees who came to the U.S. decades ago. Jack, can you tell us a little bit more about the group that's being targeted?
Yeah, there was a 2008 agreement between Vietnam and the United States that until recently the U.S. interpreted that as meaning that migrants who arrived here before 1995 between normalization of relations were protected from removal orders, deportation. Trump administration is now reinterpreting that and saying, no, we can deport these folks, and that's causing a great deal of concern.
Marisa, members of the Vietnamese community, or at least older members, tend to vote Republican. So I'm wondering how this is going to go over with California Republican leaders.
Well, I mean, this is just like the latest sort of bad news from Washington. I mean, you know, Republicans already lost every congressional seat in Orange County. I think that, you know, people who have been critics of Trump, like consultant Mike Madrid, Chad Mays, former Republican assembly leader, really lashed out at this. But that's not a big surprise because they have problems with the way that the entire party is acting and what it's doing to California conservatives. I think the thing that's interesting here, like you said, older Vietnamese have been a core constituency for Republicans historically. That does seem to be changing with younger members of that community. But I think that this is really just bad news for them. And it could play in other areas besides Orange County. I know that Mike Madrid brought up the issue of the Central Valley and other Southeast Asian populations who may also feel threatened by this.
Marisa Lagos, political reporter for KQED and co-host of Political Breakdown Podcast, and Jack Pitney, Roy P. Crocker, professor of politics at Claremont McKenna College. Jack, Marisa, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, we just heard about Vietnamese voters in Orange County. It's the largest Vietnamese population outside of Vietnam. We'll factor in how the Catholic Church weighs in when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. Orange County is home to the largest Vietnamese population outside of Vietnam. Most came as refugees fleeing communist repression after the Vietnam War, including many Catholics. That history is central for Vietnamese immigrants, and they're about to make it a visible part of the county's Catholic community. KPCC's Aaron Schrank reports.
At 12 noon on April 30th, a North Vietnamese tank broke the gate at the President's Palace in Saigon.
When the Vietnam War ended, Father Thuynh Van Nguyen was studying to be a Catholic priest. Nguyen's seminary was closed. He was thrown into a re-education camp for a year.
I had planned to become a priest, and my dream was cut off, and there's no way to practice my religion.
He escaped Vietnam by boat in 1982. First to the Philippines, then to Orange County, following a brother who fled to Camp Pendleton. Nguyen is now a priest at Blessed Sacrament Catholic Church in Westminster. Throughout his experience, he says he took comfort in a 200-year-old Vietnamese story of the Virgin Mary appearing to persecuted Catholics.
They ran to a jungle, the area called La Vang. They were hungry, they were sick, but Our Lady appeared to them and tell them to make use of leaves for medicine.
This reported apparition of Mary in Vietnamese dress holding the baby Jesus is known as Our Lady of La Vang. She is for Vietnamese Catholics what Our Lady of Guadalupe is for many in Mexico. That's why the Orange Diocese is building a 16-foot marble statue enshrined to her.
The actual shrine where Our Lady will stand, it's going to be that corner.
Project manager Elizabeth Nguyen shows me around the construction site at Christ Cathedral in Garden Grove. Standing next to the modernist glass megachurch known as the Crystal Cathedral before the Orange Diocese purchased the property, Nguyen makes a confession. Before she started fundraising for this project,
I personally never knew who Our Lady of La Vang was.
As part of her research, Nguyen reached out to relatives in Vietnam.
They basically say, wow, you're like two generations removed from us. Why do you want to know about this now? I said, well, you know, this is something I'm interested in.
There are now more than 100,000 Vietnamese Catholics in the Orange Diocese and 16 parishes with Vietnamese masses. Father Christopher Pham led one at Christ Cathedral on a recent Sunday.
The Vietnamese, we went through so many sufferings. So people, they always looking for God, Mary. Extremely Vietnamese people, they love Mary a lot.
The community has already raised more than $10 million to pay for the shrine to Our Lady of Lavang. Loyola Marymount professor and Jesuit priest Long Ngo still remembers the song he learned about her as a boy at the end of the Vietnam War.
The song was, "Oh Mary, our mother, have pity on us, on our country. It was torn, destroyed by war."
The Lavang story didn't come from church doctrine and has never been formally validated by the Vatican. Ngo says Lavang is a testament to the oral and devotional tradition of lay people throughout multiple wars and persecutions.
It's not simply about the apparition of lady. It's the new layers of pain, of suffering, of death, of loss. Especially for the overseas Vietnamese, we can resonate with this experience.
Our Lady Lavang is really a symbol, if not the symbol, that facilitates reconnection among Vietnamese Catholic refugees around the world.
Lavang scholar Den Hong Nen in Sacramento says this image of Mary has inspired shrines from D.C. to Vegas. Father Twin Van Nguyen hopes the OC Shrine, set to open in June, helps carry the Lavang legacy to the next generation.
For the Vietnamese Americans to know what their ancestors have contributed and to make them more proud and more active when we leave this world.
He also hopes it can serve as a pilgrimage site for those who can't travel home to Vietnam. Covering religion and diaspora, I'm Aaron Schrank.
Turning now to Sun Valley. A year ago, Keith Jackson was riding his bicycle along Latuna Canyon Road when he was struck from behind and the driver sped away. Jackson lived, though he suffered a traumatic brain injury. Others who cycle, run, or ride horses along the road haven't been so lucky. Some who've been hit by motorists speeding along Latuna Canyon have died. Area activists have lobbied the city for decades to make safety improvements, and today is finally the day. The Los Angeles Department of Transportation will unveil its long-awaited improvements to Latuna Canyon, including a protected bicycle lane, high-visibility pavement markers, and a shared road shoulder for bicyclists and equestrians. Joining us now are Damian Kevitt, a hit-and-run survivor and Safe Streets advocate, and also Scott Froschauer, who directs the Latuna Canyon Association. Damian and Scott, welcome to Take Two.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Scott, let's start with you. I understand you've been advocating for changes along this stretch of Latuna Canyon Road for about 40 years now. So what made that road so unsafe, in your opinion?
It's a really tricky road because it wasn't designed to be an on-ramp for the 210, which is what it's really become. It's become a major connector between the 210 and Sunland Boulevard. So now it's this massive traffic thoroughfare. And then the road was never engineered to handle the kind of traffic that it handles now.
Do you have any sense of how many people have been injured or killed by cars on Latuna Canyon Road?
I don't keep track of those specific numbers, so it would just be anecdotal. But anecdotally, it's a frightening road to live on.
Later this morning, Councilwoman Monica Rodriguez, who represents the Sun Valley area, and L.A. Department of Transportation Chief Salida Reynolds will unveil a new road improvement plan. What exactly, Scott, is the city doing to make the road more safe?
There's been an issue with a concept called traffic surveys. And traffic surveys are how the city determines what speed limits are going to be. And that's been an issue citywide, that the city hasn't been able to enforce speed limits because they haven't been able to perform traffic surveys. And this project is very specific about how to get traffic survey done on Latuna Canyon Road so that speed limits can be established, so that speed limits can be enforced. Another side of it is just philosophical, reducing the desire for people to want to speed on the road. Ways of presenting the road that when somebody sees it, they don't think to themselves, oh, this is a freeway. Yeah. And one of the ways that that happens is, you know, people use a term like road diet, but it's also, it's changing it from looking like a freeway to looking like a residential street, which is what it is.
Damian Kevitt, when it comes to hit and runs, the issue of hit and runs on Latuna Canyon, how big of an issue is it there? Is it around the city? I know that Keith Jackson, who suffered a brain injury after being hit by a car on Latuna, will also be speaking at today's event. But Damian, hit and run accidents, I mean, how big of a problem is this?
LA is arguably the hit and run capital of the U.S. I don't have the most current figures, but an earlier report from, I believe, around 2015, 2014 cited that the number of hit and runs was up at around 48% of all collisions in Los Angeles are hit and runs.
Almost half.
One in two. So if you've been hit, you have a one in two chance that that person is going to run. This compares to the national average, which ranges around 11 to 15% for most places across the U.S. So it's a huge big deal. And there's various different theories as to why this is such a problem in Los Angeles. And the plain simplicity of it is the people run. So you actually don't know. We don't know what's the main factor, what's causing this in Los Angeles to be such a main problem. But in Latuna Canyon, there was a specific incident where a cyclist was hit by a speeding SUV and left for dead on the side of the road. He suffered a traumatic brain injury and was in a coma for 2 weeks. And his family, they regularly would do Latuna Canyon. The one request that they had was, please help us make Latuna Canyon safer. And that's ultimately how I connected up with Scott, who had been trying to accomplish the same thing for decades.
Talking to Damian Kevitt, hit and run survivor, founder of the organization Streets Are for Everyone, and also Scott Froschauer, director of the Latuna Canyon Association. Damian, tell us why you are so involved in this. You have a very personal angle on all this.
In February 2013, I was bicycling with my wife in Griffith Park, and I was hit and dragged a quarter of a mile underneath a car from the streets down the 5 freeway at freeway speeds. And the fact that I'm alive to be able to talk to anyone today and to work on this subject is truly miraculous. So the subject of hit and runs, the subject of safer streets for pedestrians, for kids, for cyclists, it's something that you could say I know from the ground up. And it's something that I work passionately with a number of other individuals to prevent lives from being lost.
And Scott, so what finally got the city to go ahead and make the safety improvements that are being unveiled later this morning?
When Keith was hurt and Damian came in, the DOT had already put together a strategy for something they wanted to do to Latuna Canyon Road. But when they presented it to the community said that it wasn't appropriate. And so they knew that they weren't going to get community buy-in for this plan they had, so they shelved their proposal. Damian has the ability to get a lot of stuff done. And when he showed up and he said to DOT, you need to make some changes here, they said, we've been trying to make some changes, but the community is rejecting the changes that we're proposing. And Damian said, well, then why don't you listen to what the community is trying to do? And so to me, the story of the changes in Latuna is really based on this collaboration between DOT and the community. And to me, one of the reasons why I think that the political powers that are involved with this are so excited is because it becomes a template for how this can be successful in other parts of the city.
Damian, how did you make that happen?
You know, it was really bringing a critical mass on the whole thing. And we had some excellent leadership from Councilmember Monica Rodriguez's office, who insisted that all the players come to the table. And LADOT brought in some engineers, and there was a lot of discussion. And I have to acknowledge Scott for his work to really bring the community to the table. And you know, not every single person had the same view as to what should be done on Latuna Canyon. There's a lot of different viewpoints as to what's considered safe and how much should be done and how much is too much.
And then how do you agree?
And
right?
Yeah. And it was the impetus of Keith Jackson's traffic collision. It was a lot of work by my staff at Streets Are For Everyone to reach out to the community, to let DOT know, to let the office, the council member's office know that this was something that was wanted. It just needed to be done correctly. And I really think LADOT has learned some valuable lessons from some of the previous problems they ran into where they didn't do community outreach in correct amounts, in the magnitude that was needed. And this was, you know, people could argue that maybe it wasn't done perfectly. I really honestly feel it was done correctly. There may have been some things where not every single person is happy, but not every single person. There's always a situation where someone's not happy. It was done correctly in this case, and it was brought to the point where basically everyone was happy.
That's Damian Kevitt, hit and run survivor, founder of the organization Streets Are For Everyone, and also Scott Froschauer, director of the Latuna Canyon Association, about new safety improvements along Latuna Canyon Road in Sun Valley that are being unveiled later this morning. Damian, Scott, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Miss.
You probably heard or know most of the Christmas classics, White Christmas, Jingle Bells. Yeah, you've heard them a million times. But there are scores of households all over L.A. that are in a completely different Christmas song universe, an all-Spanish one. Coming up, here's some of our favorites, and trust us, we're going way beyond Feliz Navidad. That's ahead when Take 2 continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Ian Martinez. Same old Christmas music got you tuning out? Well, maybe you should try another language.
Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad.
No, not that one. There are a plethora of great holiday songs in Spanish, way beyond the one. Our own Jill Ruplegal has put together a playlist of some of the best, including KPCC staff picks, and she's here to give us a sample. Hello, Jill.
Hi.
All right, so why make this list?
Well, I'm not a native Spanish speaker. You might be able to tell from my name, but I've spent many years in Latin America, and still, up until recently, I didn't know a single Christmas song in Spanish, except for Feliz Navidad, which has been played ad nauseum on the radio around the holidays since I was born. So a few years ago, when I was working for an English language newspaper in Costa Rica, I did some investigating and found this wonderful, diverse world of holiday music in Spanish that at least, you know, me, gringa, did not have any idea about.
Yeah, there are a lot of songs, Jill, that, people outside of the Spanish-speaking community may have no idea exist, yet they're in households all over L.A., all up and down California. I got one from my living room called Ande la María Morena, which I think we're going to get to in just a bit, right?
Yes, we are, I promise.
My uncle burned up that 45 disc, if anyone remembers what that is, every single December 1st. All right, so what do you have for us?
Okay, so I thought we'd start with a classic. It's actually one that you also proposed and a bunch of other colleagues. And if you know any holiday songs in Spanish beyond Feliz Navidad, you probably know this one. Love this song.
It's a great song. It is.
This is the first Christmas song my daughter learned in Costa Rica, so I had to put the kid version in. But, you know, it's been covered by everyone. You know, the Colombian pop singer Juanes does it. I found a metal version on the internet, any style you can think of.
Yeah, say you're a Spanish pop artist today and you want to do a Christmas album, this song has to be on it.
Burrito Sabanero, for sure.
All right, so what's next?
All right, the next one was also nominated by several KPCC staffers, Navidad y Año Nuevo by Los Panchos. Los Panchos was a trio that started playing in the 1940s and became very famous throughout Latin America for their romantic ballads.
Ya viene la noche buena, la Navidad, con sus lindas posaditas para gozar. El niño Dios en su cuna nos brinda paz y yo en la luz de tus ojos voy a encontrar mi felicidad.
I love the guitar in that song. It's really beautiful.
This is one of those songs where I think every Christmas album has a certain song. There's the fun ones. There's the one we just heard, Burrito Sabanero. But then this one is the one where you reflect on your blessings.
Right.
That's
right.
The kind of, because of the guitar, exactly. It's kind of solemn a little bit, but it makes you kind of think about, oh, we're in Christmas time.
Yeah,
we're in
on
holiday
the couch
season.
With your family.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Now, here's the thing, though. No, there can't be a Spanish album without something a little danceable.
Yes.
So what do you got for us?
For sure. This next one is from Gabriel Romero y su orquesta from Colombia. It's called Maldita Navidad, or Damn Christmas.
Ay, maldita Navidad. Ya vienes con tu bullicio. Veo que todos se divierten. Para mí es un sacrificio.
So he goes on to say, oh, damn Christmas, you come with your noise. You know, I see everyone having fun, but for me, it's a sacrifice. And, you know, as you know, there's a large subset of these kinds of blue Christmas songs in Spanish.
When my mom married my stepdad's white from the San Fernando Valley, grew up with the traditional American Christmas songs. When this song played in our living room, a couple of my aunts got up and started moving around, started wiggling around. I mean, how can you not, right? It's the song. And he asked, well, what are you guys doing? And they said, well, just because it's Christmas doesn't mean we can't dance.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
That's the excuse, just to get up and dance.
Yeah, nothing like a little cumbia to make you forget your misery.
All right, Jill, what do you got next?
I wanted to include one from a local artist. So this is from Gabby Moreno, LA local. She's originally from Guatemala. And she has just a really lovely Christmas album. And the song is called El Niño del Tambor.
Los pastorcitos quieren ver a su rey. Le caen regalos en su humilde zurrón. Ro-po-pon-pon, ro-po-pon-pon. Ha nacido en un portal de Belén. El niño.
So obviously that's our little drummer boy in Spanish. Yeah. And, you know, as I was talking to my husband about it, about these songs, and I was trying not to include songs that we know in English that are also in Spanish. Yeah. He said, well, how do you know that they were in English first, which is a good point.
True, yeah. And you know what?
A lot of these songs are in German.
Yeah, and this song, okay, I'll tell you what, Joe, this song used to stress me out. The reason why is because it seemed to always be building to something that never happened. It used to be this da-da-da-da, and I just didn't want to hear it after a while. Because, number one, it was a favorite in my family. They played it all the time, and I got sick of hearing it. So,
well, I hope Gabby Moreno's version is a little more soothing.
A little bit better. I'm not so bah humbug about this. All right, I think we've got time for one more.
Great. I'm going to let you introduce this one, A, since it was your pick.
Ande, 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 la María Morena. This is one of those songs I mentioned earlier. I knew it was Christmas when I heard this song because it would be right around December. I don't know why my uncle chose December 1st as the time. I mean, I guess it makes sense, right? But I thought if you're going to do something Christmas-related, holiday-related, it would be right after Thanksgiving. But he'd wait. He'd wait that little pocket of time. He'd wait till December 1st, and then, bam, this song comes on.
I appreciate that.
Ande, 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 la María Morena. Ande, 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 que la noche buena. Ande, 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 la María Morena. Ande, 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 que la noche buena.
So I'm guessing, A, that might not have been the version that was included when you were little, but I picked this one because I just thought it was a great updated version. What do you think?
Yeah, I like it. Here's the thing, though. You know why I like this song so much is because not a lot of people know what it means. Different people have different versions of what La María Morena means. Some people think it's the Virgin Mary. Some people think it's something else. Everyone has their own seemingly personal connection to what the meaning of the song is, which is why I kind of liked it. So everyone has this song, and it's theirs, and it's just theirs for whatever reason they have in their heart.
That's great.
All right. So, so how can we find the entire playlist, Jill, that you put together?
You can find the playlist on our website, laist.com. That's laist.com.
All right. That's KPCC's Orange County reporter, Jill Replicle, telling us about Spanish holiday songs beyond Feliz Navidad. Jill, thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thanks for your suggestions.
Every year, the Surfrider Foundation releases its State of the Beach report card. They evaluate 30 states on policies to protect beaches from things such as erosion and sea level rise. For example, Texas and Florida got a D, Hawaii a C. One state got an A. It's the state you're standing on. Find out how we aced our report card when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm E. Martinez. The Surfrider Foundation's annual State of the Beach report card is out, and only one state got an A grade.
California.
Yeah, us, California. Each year, Surfrider grades 30 U.S. states on their policies to protect beaches from coastal erosion, sea level rise, and poorly planned coastal development. And the majority, well, they're not doing so well. Stephanie Sikich-Quinn is the Coastal Preservation Manager with the Surfrider Foundation. She joins us now to talk about this year's report card. Stephanie, welcome.
Good morning, A.
Now, as we mentioned, California, only state to get an A. What are we doing right?
Well, we are doing a lot right, and you might remember our conversation from last year that kind of highlighted what, you know, we're doing in California.
Yeah.
And the majority of our high marks and quite frankly, our beautiful beaches, can go back to our historic Coastal Act that we passed in 1976. And as I mentioned last year, there's really no law like it really in all of the country and even some parts of the world. And that law has really kind of carved up how we deal with the very specific things that surf riders are actually grading. And that is, you know, how do we manage our beaches, the sediment that is on our beaches? How do we deal with development, redevelopment? How do we deal with coastal armoring? And then most importantly, and increasingly most importantly, is how do we deal with sea level rise?
So California's been dug in on this for a long time. Tell us more about sea level rise. How is California preparing for that?
Yeah, well, in this year alone, I mean, honestly, you know, I live here, so I'm partial, but I didn't think that California could outdo itself. And it did again this year, particularly with sea level rise, to your point. So in 2018 alone, there were four or five different reports that were produced to further our thinking on not only planning, but projections. So to dig into that a little bit more, the Coastal Commission released guidance on how residential areas are going to deal with sea level rise. And A, this is actually becoming very clear that there needs to be a lot of guidance in this area. You know, this is the first time that as a country we're dealing with threats like sea level rise that will be impacting millions of people along the coast. So to give guidance to, you know, local municipalities and residents on how to deal with this is tremendous. And again, no state is doing this. Yeah.
Now, and coastal erosion, I want to get that in, too. That was a big issue in Orange County's Capistrano Beach just last week. Its boardwalk crumbled into the ocean. Stephanie, how exactly does erosion happen and how can it be prevented?
Right. So, you know, there's two types of erosion I usually kind of like to bring up to people. There's the cyclical, natural, episodic erosion that happens with just plain coastal geology. And that is the ebb and flow of our waves and how sand is deposited on our shores. There's, you know, sand that comes from off coast, which is called the littoral cell, and it's a cycle. And sometimes, you know, when we have El Ninos or we have more king tides, we can see an increase in erosion. It's cyclical. It's natural. But as you know, humans have flocked to the coast. And for centuries, we've probably built too close to the coast. So we're seeing that uncomfortable tension of coastal erosion quite, you know, up front because we're living along our coastlines. And then obviously the second type of erosion is what we're starting to see more. And that is coming in the waves of more extreme weather events. As our ocean warms, we're seeing more really intense storms, both coasts, actually. Our El Ninos are starting to increase. And then finally, we're starting to see sea level rise, and that's becoming more predominant on both coasts. Of course, the East Coast is a little bit more problematic. Yeah. But those are the kind of coastal erosion things that we look at and that are just permanent.
And Stephanie, really quick, that was one of the reasons why some of those states got low grades, so the ones that are impacted by extreme weather events.
Correct. Exactly. So, you know, we like to say, unfortunately, we like to say that the majority of states that are sitting in harm's way and extreme weather events, unfortunately, have the poorest grades. And that is reflected that, you know, only 23 out of 31 states and territories, because we grade Puerto Rico, basically are getting a C or a D. So they really need to up, you know, not just sea level rise planning, but really being methodical about how they look at development, redevelopment, and coastal armoring as well.
Stephanie Sikich-Quinn is the Coastal Preservation Manager with the Surf Rider Foundation. She's been speaking with us about the new 2018 State of the Beach Report Card and California's A grade. Stephanie, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Staying with the coast, Napster founder Sean Parker is bucking the system again. When Parker failed to get permission from the California Coastal Commission to have his elaborate wedding in Big Sur, he faced some hefty fines before finding a way to make the situation work for him. Instead of going up against the commission with a lawsuit, he decided to strike a deal and use his resources to build an app that lets beach lovers know where they can go on the coast. 5 years later, Parker has worked with the Coastal Commission to launch the Your Coast app. It tells you where more than 1,000 beaches are accessible in California, along with available parking, trails, and dog-friendly zones. And it also includes pictures so you know if you're in the right place. So even if you're not a billionaire, you can avoid those hefty fines. All right, finally, the weekend's around the corner. We're here to help.
I'm Christine Ziemba from LAist.
And I'm KPCC's Leo Duran. The holidays are getting closer, and so is this weekend. So here are things to do.
Now, this first event is for the birds, literally. For more than a century, the Audubon Society has run an annual Christmas bird count throughout North America. Here in LA, there's a count on Saturday from 8 a.m. to noon at Debs Park in Montecito Heights. Volunteer to tally up the different birds while hiking around assigned areas of the park. And don't worry if you have very little birding experience, because each group is assigned to work with a qualified expert. RSVPs are needed, so check the weekend events column on LAist for more info.
You can also hear some beautiful songbirds this weekend as well.
Santa baby, un abrigo quiero tener de mink.
Oh, bueno.
Yeah, this is a cover of Santa Baby by the Grammy Award-winning all-female mariachi group Mariachi Divas. They perform a special Christmas concert tomorrow night in Downey. They'll be playing new songs, old songs, reimagined old songs like this one, and more. It should be very high energy and a rocking good time. And tickets for that start at $32.
And LA's Troubadour Theater Company, a.k.a. The Troubies, are back with their annual holiday send-up, The Year Without a Santana Claus.
Okay.
It's a musical parody that mixes tunes by Carlos Santana with the 1970s claymation TV special, The Year Without a Santa Claus. The show runs Wednesdays to Sundays through December 30th. But this Sunday and next, the audience is invited to stay for a chips and salsa reception with free dancing lessons after the show. So tickets run between $45 and $75.
And then finally, here's a more offbeat version of a holiday show. So, Christine, I'm a sucker for some good performance art. Sometimes it's really head-scratching. Other times it's mind-blowing. This one will be the latter because it's by this artist who's in drag. Okay, so this guy, his name is Taylor Mack, and last time he performed here in LA, he did this series that looked back on American music. It was raucous and fun because the audience is a major part of the show. He does it again tonight and tomorrow, but with a Christmas twist. This show he's doing is called Taylor Mack's Holiday Sauce, S-A-U-C-E, and it's at UCLA. He'll celebrate all the fun and dysfunction you can find in holiday music. There'll also be a drag pop-up station, an ugly sweater contest, and more. This is most definitely for mature audiences, by the way. And tickets for this start at $26. Now, there's actually so much more to do than just that. You can find our whole list of events on LAist.com. That is LAIST.com.
And I'm LAist Christine Ziemba.
I'm KPCC's Leo Duran.
Have a great weekend.
That's going to do it for Take Two this week. Our producers are Lori Galaretta and Austin Cross. Audrey Noe and Julia Paskin helped us out this week. Our news apprentice is Emily Henderson. The show is edited by Sue Carpenter. Leo Duran directed the show, and our engineer is Hasmik Pogosian. Senior producer is Megan Larson. Ami Martinez. We'll be back here on Monday. Hope you have a great weekend. Up next, Air Talk with Larry Mantle. Hello, Larry.
Hey, good morning. You know, few things in parenting are as divisive as spanking. The most recent survey I've seen shows majority of American parents still believe that spanking, at least occasionally, is acceptable practice. We have a case of a Central Valley state legislator who's actually arrested after spanking his daughter when she showed a mark from the spanking at school the next day. We're going to talk about the latest research on spanking, hear from listeners what they think about it, and how far is too far, even if someone supports it.
When I was a kid, the threat of the spank was almost just as bad, right?
Yeah.
It'd be like a cloud over your head.
Yeah, definitely. Times have changed, so we'll talk about. And a number of celebrities and sports figures have come out in favor of spanking. So we'll talk about the ongoing controversy.
All right. Air Talk with Larry Mantle coming up at 10. Thanks, Larry.
Thanks, A.